Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. As I say every week, I hope we could not do it without you. Would you tell Mike that I am not fixated on Google? He keeps saying that just because I'm going to talk again about a book tonight. We're going to have a senior editor from Wired Magazine talk about Google in the book called The Plex. It doesn't mean I'm fixated on Google. I think when you hear these things, you'll see that Google's fixated on me and us. Anyway, it'll be fun. We have a long broadcast tonight, and we can't do it all, but, you know, this is the first step in learning, and you can do the second step to hear the rest of this presentation on your own. But it's a fascinating little book. It's called The Plex. It's written by Stephen Levy, and it's how Google thinks, works, and shapes our lives, even if you don't want it to. And that'll be some surprises probably, too, as you listen to the presentation. But welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, the Jumble Justice Radio Show. What a deal, right? I'm your host, Keith Haley. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you again for taking us on that trip across the country in your truck cab or somebody else's truck cab. And he visits 90 cities and states, I think, in that presentation. Yes, it's 90. I'm kidding. Emily, thank you very much for gathering some news for us tonight. We've got some good ones, that's for sure. She always gets us the best stories we can find. The purpose of this thing we call the Jumble Justice Radio Show is to discuss news and issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to these people that work in criminal justice, and they work in policing and courts, corrections, and juvenile justice at all levels. And they do it in the United States, and they do it in other nations, and they probably do it in places we've never even heard of, and they still work for the United States government when they do that. We try to take a close-up look at criminal justice practice and its professionals. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, talk about leading technology. Buddy, I'm ashamed to say that. Has anybody written a book about Blog Talk Radio? Whoa, there's an idea if nobody has. Here's a medium that Alan Levy invented. And I don't think Stephen Levy's any relation to him. The author of the book we're going to talk about tonight, he could be, I don't know. But he's CTO of Blog Talk Radio Network. As I say, the genius behind the medium and what's possible you, your friends, anybody you want, any interest group, can have a live radio show broadcasting worldwide on the internet to an unlimited number of listeners, and it costs you absolutely nothing, and I think you can sign up in literally minutes, so just a few minutes to do that, and you could be broadcasting. These shows are archived, the ones that we do, and the others on Blog Talk Radio Network, or you can go to podcastdirectory.com if you'd like to hear a show again. That or look at all the shows on Podcast Directory. How many would there be? Does anybody even make a guess on that, Mike? We could have a lottery on that. How many shows has Blog Talk Radio archived? I mean, it would be just incredible. I already told you what's going on tonight. So during the little news segment, if you'd like to call in on 347-996-5983, you're welcome to do it. We can hold more than one call if people choose to do that. But let's go ahead and start off tonight with Audrey's blonde joke. She purposely made it short tonight because she knows we have a long guest broadcaster. And Audrey, what's this one about? Oh, I know what it is. Okay, go ahead. Let's hear it, Audrey. By the way, if you're listening for the first time, Audrey is a blonde. She's from London, England, and she loves blonde jokes, and she is not offended by them whatsoever. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is very short but funny. I know our featured presenter about Google has a lot to say, so the short joke works fine for this evening. Here it is. A blonde was having sharp pains in her side. The doctor examined her and said, "You have acute appendicitis." The blonde yelled at the doctor, "I came here to get medical help, not get a stupid compliment."
We like that one. And related to something we're going to talk about tonight, remember, you've got all those guns on the street in the United States, over 200 million of them somewhere. I guess we're sending a whole bunch of them to Mexico if you've been listening to our show, so we're probably losing some. That's the famous ATFE, don't forget explosives, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives federal unit has lost track of several thousand guns, maybe it's 1,400, I forget what it is, that went into Mexico, and some have been found, continue to be found at the scene of crime scenes where people have been hurt, injured, and that poor Border Patrol agent for the United States was killed. The Ohio Coalition would like for you to lay down your guns, and one of our stories tonight is about a police buyback program. I'll have comments about that when we get to the news segment. But go ahead, Ohio Coalition, and we hope that the criminals listening tonight will hear you and go down and turn in their guns to the police department.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
You know, somebody asked me the other day, I should know that. I'm embarrassed to tell you I don't, but how many people have concealed carry licenses in Ohio? That'd be pretty easy to check probably on the site. And I think, did they do the deal here where anybody that's a CCW license holder and anybody can get that information about that? Did that go through? I can't remember if it did. But in other words, if you've got a CCW license and you like not everybody to know that, I think they can. I think that's a public record. So it doesn't seem right that we'd be doing something like that. But, I guess it tells the burglar which house not to break into if they had, you know, access to a lot of those. All right, how about a green tip? We are trying to save the planet. I understand that Al Gore is going to come out of hiding this fall and come out with something new about going green. He's not happy about some of this research and counter to his particular findings, movies, Nobel Prize winning on the saving the planet. But we can't negate the value of saving the planet. It is getting warmer. Has anyone noticed that? It has been warmer here the last month. Well, that's right, it's August. Okay, I'm sorry. But we're using Esma Floyd's little book, and her book is entitled 1001 little ways to save the planet. And here's one that I suspect people haven't thought a lot about. It's tip number 721. And it says, make a little tea. Don't boil more water than you need for one cup of tea or coffee, but make sure you cover the elements completely. The energy wasted boiling a kettle full of water instead of one cup's worth just three times a day, listen to this, could be enough to power one energy-saving light bulb for 9 hours. That's that little screwed-up little bulb that you have to call the fire department if the thing breaks. Just by doing a kettle, you're wasting that much energy. That could power one of those little bulbs for like 9 hours. I mean, that one struck me, so I'm going to be careful about boiling water from now on. Only boil the exact amount that you need. So that is really something. Well, let's take a look at some of the news tonight. It continues to be interesting in criminal justice, as always. So let's crank that up and see what we got. We're going to take a look first here. We've got in Cocoa and Palm Bay in Florida. They are actually went through a gun buyback program. They were able to take nearly 500 guns off the streets last year. Now, that's a bit of a stretch when they say take them off the streets, because they were taking them out of people's chests, you know, out of their garage, in bedroom dresser drawers, and that type of guns that the people didn't want. But what they got for that on Friday, Broward County Law Enforcement Agency will again hold their drop-off. As part of the annual Kicks for Guns campaign to get unwanted firearms off the street. A lot of the weapons we see getting turned in are from people that don't want them. Maybe someone whose spouse has died. Not sure what they mean by that. I don't think they mean from guns. But Lon Lugo of the Palm Beach Police Department said the idea is to remove unwanted guns from the community that can potentially become the target of thieves. Barbara Matthews, a spokeswoman for the Cocoa, is that right? Cocoa? It must be Cocoa. It looks like Cocoa Police Department. I don't know much about Florida, actually. Praised the program now in its 12th year across Central Florida as a way to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. Wait a minute. It's just a drop in the bucket, but it's a start, Matthews said. But if one life is saved, if one crime is kept from happening, then it will be worthwhile. Now, let me see. Guns, 1.5 to 2 million people a year do use a firearm to ward off a felon. So now we may have homes that don't have a gun that could be the victim of a home invasion or something like that, and they would not have a firearm to ward off the felon. But I guess I see what they mean. Last year, officers exchanged gift cards for shotguns, rifles, semi-automatic handguns, and other firearms. Residents were allowed to turn in the unloaded weapons anonymously at designated stops. This year, police in Palm Bay will hand out $50 gift cards, for gas in Cocoa. The gift cards will be for groceries or retail items at Walmart, Publix, and Winn-Dixie groceries. But last year, we did run out, but fortunately, several businesses stepped up and helped out to do that. So from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. tomorrow in Palm Bay, you'll be able to drop off your guns. They give you the location, that type of thing. Have you seen this advertisement, next story? The public service announcement put out by Janet Napolitano and Homeland Security Department that portrays the terrorists. They got a lot of criticism from their first public service television announcement on the See It, Say It thing, where all the terrorists were whites, dressed up, however. And they took a lot of criticism for that because, you know, most of the terrorists aren't Caucasians, whites. There's something else. Race is very complicated, but people know what I mean. Despite causing controversy last month with a video that portrayed white middle-class Americans as the most likely terrorists, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, they released another public service announcement that depicts an attempt to bomb a subway station not by Al-Qaeda Muslims, but well-dressed white people. a new public service announcement entitled The Drop-Off, If You See Something, Say Something, was unveiled by none other than Big Sis herself, Janet Napolitano. She's from the Homeland Security. She's the director. And it shows a woman, how does the thing actually work? It shows a woman getting out of a car and going into a place, and the guy activates something like in her purse. Yeah, here it is. Shows a well-dressed, attractive white woman exiting a taxi before walking into a subway station. The taxi driver, a white man, then makes a phone call and sets a timer on a device in the trunk of the car. The woman then leaves her bag in the station. And the idea we're going to have an explosion there because of it. Now, this wouldn't be so odd. People say, well, what are you harping on this for, Haley? You know, big deal. But did you know last year, every person convicted of terrorism in the United States, there were 126. You knew that everyone was a Muslim? Every one of them was a Muslim. Now, isn't that interesting? But yet the ads don't predict. In fact, the first ad portrayed minorities actually reporting the white people, which could happen, and could happen all kinds of ways, but kind of an interesting thing. Well, this one's almost too funny. It sounds so federal. The National Security Agency's on a hiring blitz. The Cryptologic Intelligence Agency, home to the government's chief code makers and breakers, announced its intention to hire as many as 3,000 people over the next 2 years, many of them cybersecurity experts. In fact, NSA, that's our most secret federal agency, the National Security Agency, recruiters even took a trip to Las Vegas in the last few weeks to go to the DEF CON conference, and that's a high-profile computer hacker conference. So what they're saying is, you know, there are people there that know all kinds of super smart stuff, and we've talked a little bit about that, the white hats and the black hats, and people, how they jump back and forth between two different positions if they're computer hackers. But the shortage of cyber pros doesn't only affect the government, but it affects the industry also. I thought this was funny. I think it was NSA, but don't quote me on this because I don't have the article in front of me. But Mike, wasn't this a hoot that they're building these big super computers to store intelligence information and maybe do cyber snooping and all kinds of stuff? And then, after a number of months, they finally figured out that every part that they were putting in these computers to build the most secret computers in the world came from China, and China might be including stuff that could actually spy on our computers. No, that sounds so federal, doesn't it? So I guess maybe somebody in Tennessee or somewhere would be making some secret computer parts here in the future. I'm not sure, but I don't think it's a secret that China does cybersecurity and cyber snooping work, is it? I didn't think so. I got a long story here about predictive policing, and it's kind of computer centered, and I think I'm going to skip that one. But let's go to this one. This is a joke thing. You know how you get all this junk people send to you in emails, and not necessarily junk, but things like that. This is one that's supposed to be about one of our state's troopers, trooper organizations, and things that were actually recorded off of their car videos, and they're supposed to be actual things that happened where these troopers said this to the public. So these are jokes. So the first one is, the trooper says to the person, you know, stoplights don't come any redder than the one you just went through. Okay. Number two, relax, the handcuffs are tight because they're new. They'll stretch after you wear them a while. I could see him saying that. If you take your hands off the car, I'll make your birth certificate a worthless document. I hope the officer was smiling when she or he said that. It says, if you run, you'll only go to jail tired. All right, that's cool. Number five, can you run faster than 1,200 feet per second? Because that's the speed of the bullet that'll be chasing you. Well, could you say that? I guess you could say it and be smiling. You don't know how fast you were going? I guess that means I can write anything I want on the ticket, huh? You know how they always ask you, do you know how fast? I never started with a question. That always makes people angry, actually. Tell them right away what you're stopping them for, and don't ask them questions. Yes, sir, you can talk to the shift supervisor, but I don't think it will help. Oh, did I mention that I am the shift supervisor? Warning. You want a warning? Okay, I'm warning you not to do that again, or I'll give you another ticket. Okay, the answer to the last question will determine whether or not you were drunk. Was Mickey Mouse a cat or a dog? Okay, fair. You want me to be fair? Listen, fair is a place where you go to ride on rides, eat cotton candy and corn dogs and step in monkey. Well, whatever. Yay. We have a quota. Yes. Two more tickets and my wife gets a toaster oven. Says, in God we trust, all others we run through NCIC, National Crime Information Center. Just how big were those two beers you said you had? Remember, that's the standard line when the officer asks you, how much have you had to drink? I've had two beers. okay. I'm glad to hear that the chief of police is a personal friend of yours, so you know someone who can post your bail. And the winner is, according to this list, you don't think we give pretty women tickets? You're right. We don't. Sign here. It's a woman, obviously. Okay, that's funny. Stored on Evernote. If you don't use Evernote, folks, you should. If you got any kind of notes you want to keep for a long time, forever, it's free, and it's hard to actually exceed their capacity ever before you get up into the pay category. But let's go ahead and give me time to switch over here. We're going to be listening to a presentation from the author, Stephen Levy, about this book called The Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. And he is a senior writer for Wired Magazine now. And for 13 years, he was an editor for technology for Newsweek magazine. So I think you'll enjoy this if you have any interest in how Google kind of hangs around us and knows a little bit about us and like what Mr. Google says. And he's followed this, I guess, from the beginning. He's known the people at Google. So this will be interesting. But Mr. Google knows what we're thinking before we think it. So here we go. Give me a chance to switch over here. Low-end technology.
Next on Book TV, Stephen Levy, senior writer for Wired Magazine, talks about how Google operates and the impact it's had. Mr. Levy was given full access to the company for 2 years and interviewed hundreds of current and former employees for the book. This is about an hour and a half.
Hello. So I guess I'll just say, to begin with, you know, so it's about 15 years ago that a couple of grad students at Stanford set up shop in a dorm room and set something up they called PageRank. And one of them was named Larry Page, pun intended, I believe. And the other one was Sergey Brin. And their story is now pretty much the stuff of legend. And they pretty much upended the portal business. They showed the world that search was something important, and they had this dream of making all the world's information accessible. And they are continuing on that path, and a path that you have laid out in an incredibly well-documented book has at times been a tough one and gets tougher. As their dreams sort of hit against, I think, some of the realities of the world.
But the company itself, not the book.
Yes. The book is actually, You know, and it's one of these things where I'm so interested in it. It's always hard for me to tell for sure if everyone will be, but if you were at all interested in it, I found it a great, fascinating read, and I learned some things about the company. My first question to you, though, you have been covering the Valley and technology for a while. Why did you pick Google as the focus of your latest book?
I first came across Google when it was pretty early in its history. And it was just starting to get noticed around the world, really, as a much more effective way to find things on the Internet. People thought that search was pure, right? And it was as good as it was going to get. Then Google came along, and it was something so good that it was different. And it was transformative. Not only could you find what you wanted, but it opened up new frontiers so people could start things knowing they could be found. And I think I had to meet these people because I was excited about it. And to see, because when new things start out, I always want to know, is this going to be something which is a nice development or something where I really have to know the people behind this company. They're going to matter. They're going to be, make a difference in our lives. So I went down to the Googleplex as it was then, which was the first bigger building they moved into. I knew the public relations person, Cindy McCaffrey, she was from Apple Computer. I knew her then. And I said, Cindy, I want to meet these guys. It was October of 1999. And as it happened, it was Google's celebration of Halloween. And Larry was dressed like a Viking in a big fur vest. And you had a hat with big horns coming out of it. And Sergey was dressed like a cow with these huge, disgusting udders coming out. And the cow and the Viking took me into a room and described PageRank. And there was something about them which was compelling. And I thought, as it grew to an important company and then had its IPO, and it turned out to be an incredibly successful business, I thought, this could be worth a book. At that time, there were a couple books going. And I thought, I'd let them go, and I went to something else. But I felt there was something about this company which was not only different in what it gave us, but different on its own terms. And it really hit home for me in the summer of 2007 when I was invited to go along with some young Google managers. They have a program called Associate Product Managers, who are really the future leaders of Google. They are people who are paid to be not only skilled in an engineering sense, but an entrepreneurial sense as well. And every summer, Marissa Mayer, one of the key executives of Google, takes these young leaders, these product managers, to visit Google offices around the world. And I was invited to go along on a trip. We literally went around the world to Tokyo, Beijing, Bangalore, and Tel Aviv. And I spent 24/7 with those people, unmediated, which was sort of a rare experience for a journalist. And inside the company, I realized it was much more interesting than I thought. It was not just all those things I said before, but there was a cultural movement going on there. That these people were steeped in the future in a way that the predecessors in the business hadn't been. And I got a sense of what their values were, and I later learned that they were really directly channeled from Sergey Brin and especially Larry Page. And I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to tell the story of Google as much as possible from the inside, to get that experience I had with this group of 18 engineers with the company of 20,000 people as it was then. And I thought, if I could write that book, that could be something. And that's what I tried to do.
Well, you certainly did get inside, and I wondered a couple of things, and we're going to get on to what you saw on the inside in a minute, but first, how long did it take you to actually do this, and how much access were you actually given to Google in the process?
I started the book in June 2008. So it was almost 3 years. And I asked for a lot of access. Basically, the most important thing was to be able to talk to anyone I wanted to talk to. And I wanted to sit in a number of meetings, events, other things that go on there. But mainly, it was talking and talking again. I wanted to talk to the people at Google, not just Larry and Sergey and Eric, but the people who you never heard of who were key to Google. There was a number of people, as it turns out, inside of Google who were very important in developing its products. They were superstars, but they were unknown to everyone else. And they were influential in the company. And sometimes they were just wonderfully strange. And these were the people I wanted to spend time with. And not just once, but sometimes multiple times. And my time at Wired, actually the same month I started serious work on this book, I began full-time at Wired magazine. I left Newsweek and shifted to Wired. So as John mentioned, I've been writing for Wired for quite a long time as a freelancer. And it was a terrific synergistic experience that I was able to sometimes spin off articles with Google's permission, because basically everything I did inside of Google was for the book unless we had mutual consent otherwise. And that helped me.
Can I just interrupt for a minute, because didn't Sergey say to you, why are you releasing a book? Why don't you just release little chapters at a time?
There's a paradox here. Maybe we'll talk about Google Book Search later on. But if a company that takes books very, very seriously as a corpus of information, but the two founders, aren't really book people in terms of their own preferences there. And, from when Sergey said that to me, he had said to another book writer earlier, I remembered reading, and I thought, he doesn't have the same seriousness. And sometimes, working on a Wired article, he would spend a little more time with me. He never spent as much time as he did at Newsweek in the early days, of course. We'd come to New York and we'd have lunch and he was much more accessible. Google would come out with a new product, and it would be Sergey on the phone telling you about it. And you pull up on an issue, and they say, "Hold on, Sergey wants to get on the phone." In later years, and they would talk about that too. Larry and Sergey were tougher guests, but
They're bigger. They're bigger,
yeah.
I'm sure, right?
But obviously, we run into them all the time at the Googleplex there.
Yeah, I just thought that was funny that's what he said to you in the process of it. So a couple of years, you were there a lot. They gave you access to all kinds of people. You didn't feel at all like they were really guarding access to you. I mean, it seems like the things you talk about in the book, they do feel like you really are talking about things in a very factual way, moments, scary moments, whatever. They really gave you access to
it. Well, an interesting thing happened. Well, one thing that I didn't mention before is I had access to a number of projects at Google that were not public yet. So, and well in advance. And this was something that even happened on that trip there. During that trip, one thing they did was they went to every office. They would explain to the engineers of that office, here's what we're up to in Mount View. And the engineers in that office, whether it was in Bangalore or Tokyo or Haifa, would say, and here's what we're doing here. And, one of the things that the engineers at Mount View talked about was this product called Chrome, this browser they were working on. And that was a year away. So they knew that they could trust me. They keep my mouth shut and not pre-announce products there. But knowing about a lot of things that were going on in Google that weren't public opened up a level of trust, because people could talk to me about something which wasn't public. I think they came to feel that they could unburden in other things. And I also have to give Google a lot of credit. And a lot of times I'd be in an interview, and there would be a communications person in the room, more often than not. And sometimes they would look over at the person, Karen Wickery, who's out in the audience, is most often that person. They'd say, "Can we say this?" And he'd say, be fine, go ahead. And they did. And after a certain amount of time, I remember I was talking to Eric once. He was asking how it was going, before we went into our interview. And I said, it's funny, it's like learning to play guitar. At a certain point, you stop looking down where your fingers are on the chord and you just play the music. And that's the way I felt at a certain point when I was at Google. I felt very much at home there. And the people, I think, picked up on that when I interviewed them. And within a few minutes, we were talking, not so much with the distance of a journalist and a source, but almost as if, in some sense, we were collaborators or colleagues.
I mean, my experience there has largely been that they have been relatively open as companies go, especially compared to Apple, but that's a different story.
That's a different story.
you know, one of the things, let's go to sort of where the book, some of the early parts of the book, and one of the things that you actually make quite a point of saying is that both these guys went to Montessori school, and that actually understanding that is kind of key to understanding this company in terms of how they think. I mean, you have some really interesting thoughts about the kind of freedom that they experienced in school, right?
Read Maria Montessori's work to better understand them, and it was really interesting because it talked about the balance of what freedom of discipline and discipline, and it really seemed to map out a lot of the perceived philosophy of Larry and Sergey in what employees should be able to do. It's almost a liberating thing not to have to answer to authority and say what you do next. So maybe the famous 20% projects at Google.
Right. You have 20% of your time to work on something you're just excited about, right?
Right. And sometimes people pull up 120% because they have to do all the work anyway, and then they get to do 20% of things they want to do by themselves. But that seems very much in keeping with the Montessori philosophy.
Yeah.
And for Larry and Sergey themselves, they perceive it within the structure of Google. And I think it's very important for them to be free radicals inside the Google system, that they don't want to be pinned down too much, to the point where at one time they dismissed their assistants. They had a group of young women who were their assistants. They were called LSA, Larry Sergey Assistants. People would talk to them as if it was an entity. They'd say, oh, it's LSA, if, you know, Sergey could come to this, or something like that. And Larry explained to me that he just didn't like the idea that someone could say yes to a meeting for him. And they ended the assistance, and that was it. Yeah. So from there on, they were free to roam and go wherever you wanted. And it had some interesting effect on how Google employees who wanted to talk to them would have to find them.
Right, which, you know, well, I hope that LSA's stock had invested by the time they were let go.
I think they went to other places.
Yeah, so it seems, though, that there's that manifest. Now, the other thing that struck me is the actual sort of development of the core ideas behind Google, their ability to, as it were, think out of the box, which is sort of a cliche term at this point, their ability to constantly ask, well, why should it be that way? You know, for example, in advertising, the development of AdSense. On every level, it seems like these two guys, something at their core is always saying, well, why should it have to be that way?
Right, and the advertising system, AdWords was the first product, and really it is the signal product of the internet age in terms of making money. You know, there is no product in the internet which is done as well as Google AdWords, but it's even better than that because it is a product, an advertising product that people want to see. And how do we know they want to see it? Google, being Google, tests everyone, and they find out they want to see it. They give a certain percentage, they give us regularly. They still might be doing it. Sometimes you might go to the Google search engine and see no ads. That wouldn't be because no one's booked the keywords, but you're part of the test. Every time you use Google, I found you are part of the test, which blew my mind, right? We can talk about that a little later, but in this case, people search for when there's ads. Therefore, if they're happier, they want the ads. And the reason why those ads are so successful is that even though it's an auction system, the highest bidder doesn't win. The bid is modulated by how useful the ad is, how much people want to see it. So they build the ad quality into the system to make it useful to the advertiser. And that's an ideal that they managed to meet, and I thought it was a great triumph.
Well, it seems like at one point in the book you actually talk about Google sort of thinks of things as sort of a troika, where it's not just the advertiser, you know, and Google. It's the person who is seeing the ads, which in many ways this is kind of different from the way people thought about advertising before. So that Google wants the ads to actually be useful to you. And did it upset a lot of people in the traditional advertising?
Well, very much so. And largely what upset them is the idea was so measurable, because it's all based on measurement. You have to measure it in order to know how good the ads are, how useful they are. And as a result, the science in Google's ad system is just as sophisticated as the science in Google's search engine. And that's why they have so many statisticians and economists and mathematicians working on the ad side, as well as they have engineers and computer scientists and artificial intelligence specialists working on the search side.
I mean, it's sort of mystery. Is my mic working there?
Yeah.
Okay. It's sort of a depth of mystery, as you say, in advertising, because you can really know, and they've figured it out mathematically, you can really know whether or not an ad is useful to somebody.
Right. And I had a lot of fun, actually, talking to some people on the ad side. Usually when you read an article about Google, you don't see anything about salespeople. But to me, it was fascinating how the salespeople at Google, and Google still does need salespeople, even though Larry at one point asked, why do we have these people? They changed their role from sitting out over dinner and negotiating something and convincing a client to take an ad out, or an agency to get a client to take an ad out, to almost being your guide into saying how you buy these keywords and what you do there. And, and that would change when they moved away from paying for ads per impression, how many people saw it, and how many people clicked on it. And it was all taken care of. It was all measurable. So it changed that role dramatically. And some people in the ad department thought, whoa, where are we going here when we're no longer saying we're definitely going to get this money? We have a pretty good thing going here. Google was making some nice money before they switched to that system there. But Google took a deep breath and implemented this system, and it turned out to be way more successful than anything we'd seen before.
Didn't they even get General Motors who threw some of their ad people out at one point?
Right, yeah.
I'm like, well, what's wrong with you
guys? Yeah, people thought, well, even before that, just the idea of seeing these search ads, people thought this was ridiculous. We can't get involved with that. This is real advertising. This is the way things work there. And Google had a difficult time convincing people to find keywords to show up these little blocks of text were appropriate advertising vehicles for a big corporation. But when they started to point out that some huge number, 90% or something, of people who buy a car go online to research their purchase, then even General Motors figured out this is something we could get involved in.
So these guys, they come in, they're very unconventional. I'd like to, you told one story, and I think this was a serious story. They were talking about how to do transactions in countries that didn't have credit cards, and Larry Page said, well, we could take goats in Uzbekistan. These very unconventional guys, and the people who funded Google, the VCs, said, we want a grown-up to come in. And this is when Eric Schmidt comes into the company, and for many years, I just thought, was the quote-unquote grown-up in the company. How did they pick Eric?
Well, as you mentioned, the venture capitalists that put $25 million into Google in 1999 did it with the expectation that these two young men from Stanford with no experience managing a giant company would get what was called in the Valley adult supervision and hire an experienced manager to be the CEO.
Just because you dress like a cow and tell reporters things, I don't know why you need an adult, right?
There's some interesting April Fool's videos of Eric. It's fun. It says he got some fun too. But a few months after they got the money, they called John Doerr and said, we changed our mind. We think we could run this company ourselves. And John, so his first instinct was to say, I'm out of here. But he held back and said, wait a minute. Why don't you just do this? Why don't you go and talk to a number of CEOs of some of the companies in the Valley that you respect? And I'll set up this tour. They went on what I call the Magical Mystery Tour of the best CEOs, which was with Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs and all the greats. So they came back from the tour, and they said to John, you're right. We like having a CEO. We know just the person who could be our CEO. Steve Jobs.
he was otherwise engaged.
Yeah, he was a little busy, and I don't know if he was going to do that. But John finally got them to look at Eric. And there's a number of reasons why they respected Eric. He had this technical job, and he had written a program that they liked. And but Eric also was smart enough to know that he couldn't go in there and say, I'm the adult, I'm going to run the thing, step aside, and let me make the decision. Instead, he adopted a very conscious, it seemed to me, stance of, at every point, and I heard this a lot, talking about how brilliant Larry and Sergey were. And he would talk about how much he learned from Larry and Sergey. And, you know, Eric would do the things at Google that helped make it an effective corporation, but he yielded some of his autonomy. There was this troika system where, on some important matters, two out of three voted, and you could say that in certain respects, Larry and Sergey were a block in that voting structure. Eric was successful slowing down some things that Larry and Sergey wanted to do right away. For instance, the browser we mentioned earlier. Larry and Sergey wanted to do that earlier. And Eric was very concerned about Microsoft noticing how well Google was doing, noticing what a good deal search was. And he didn't want to moon the giant, as he said. And Eric's history, Microsoft was a big, scary company. He didn't want to take them on. He lived through the browser wars. That hadn't ended too well for Netscape, on whose side he was rooting. So he slowed that down. But Larry and Sergey, they look ahead. They don't worry about who's in a space that they think is interesting for Google to go. They just go. They just dive in. So it was an interesting dynamic that Eric was able to sometimes stave off their impulses and sometimes not. But sometimes, and Eric would be the first to admit this, he would say, you know what, I thought we shouldn't do that, and I was wrong.
Yeah.
And there's a number of things, like going and bidding a lot of money to get the AOL business in search, which was actually very important for Google.
Yeah, well, it seems like for many years he was able to navigate that, and perhaps in confronting Microsoft, that may have been, you know, a wise decision. I wanted to ask about something in the book that I did not know, which is that Google is one of the largest computer manufacturers in the world. This was fascinating to me. I had no idea, and then when you explained why, I was like, oh, of course. And I'm thinking probably that may surprise people here as well. Explain why it is Google is one of the largest computer makers in the world.
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to do in the book was talk about the data centers. Google, and that's really one of the biggest secrets there. And I was looking at a couple ways in learning about it. And one was they were getting a little more open than they used to be. Not open enough to say, Stephen, come to a data center and explore it. But as it turned out, doing an early story for Newsweek, I had gone to one of Google's data centers when they were leasing space in a co-location center not far from here. But there were some ex-employees who were a little more verbose about the data center. And then there were some publications, scientific publications that Google had, which were available that you could learn. So you could piece together something there. And people always talk about how many computers Google has, how many servers they have, and they build them themselves. And no one really knows the number. At a certain point, they stop telling you, and then they admitted 100,000. They said, okay, you could say that. And it was probably much more. Then the number sort of stopped at a million, but Google's much bigger, so really no one knows how much it is, but a million really is the baseline there. There's many, many.
I guess the question is, why are they building their own? Why did they build their own rather than go and buy them from, say, Dell or something? You know, what was the reason?
It's cheap. It's cheap. Is the reason, and frugality is part of Google's success, particularly in that. When you talk about millions of computers, cost is a big problem. And they do an interesting thing with those computers there. Other companies might think, you know what, we're going to not be penny wise and pound foolish. We're going to buy the good equipment that doesn't break down. people take the opposite approach. They say, we're going to buy the crappiest equipment and sometimes tweak it so it gets a little better. But we're going to operate a system so it's built for failure. It's easy to deal with it when one of the servers goes down. We could swap it out really quickly. And they found out that in the long run, that stands them much better. And in a way, Google is the most successful failure system that's ever invented. They built in redundancy. Their software system, and it's extremely innovative, is really built to handle failure very, very successfully. And you could argue maybe that in the way they roll out products, some of that goes out too. Their system is built to handle failure in products. They figure if you're not failing a certain amount of products, you're not trying hard.
Well, that may be, I mean, you know, for example, Gmail was in beta for 5 years, I think.
Yeah.
Right? So that they could just, and it was only in beta. We haven't really released it yet.
Right.
Like,
I think Google single-handedly destroyed the term beta. They didn't mean that.
I think it's sort of like Spider-Man in New York City being previews for, I don't know,
yeah.
Right? They keep doing that.
Talk about failure, yeah.
Exactly. You know, artificial intelligence is also, and I think as the company got bigger and moved along, they started to realize increasingly more and more that they had to be involved in artificial intelligence. And I would say in the book, you mentioned something, too, about how Larry said, well, we just like to install little search engines in everyone's brain. But they haven't quite done that.
It was kind of funny. Every year, Google has these elaborate April Fool's things. And I noticed how closely the fantasy, over-the-top subjects of their April Fool's jokes are things that Larry and Sidney really want to make happen. You know, they talk about these artificial intelligence systems will do this for you, do that for you. And maybe a self-driving car would have been an appropriate April Fool's joke early in Google's history, and now they're building it, right? So, and you say an increasing reliance on artificial intelligence. It was always there.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to some of my very early interviews with Larry and Sergey, and they were going on at length about artificial intelligence very, very early in their history. And as it turns out, as the search engine evolved, artificial intelligence learning became more and more a factor in that. Everyone knows about PageRank, for example, not everyone, but people who associate Google, they learned about in the earlier days. They said, well, the search engine is fantastic because it relies on this democracy of the web. What people think is important on the web is what Google identifies as important for a search. And that was a huge breakthrough, and it helped Google rise above the crowd there. But as Google search engine evolved, it drew its power from learning. It learns from the data that people give it when they react to the search engine. So all those clicks you do when you go to a search engine, you choose a result, or maybe you say, this doesn't work, I'm going to put it in another term. This is information that Google uses to find out if you're happy. And Google learns about the world from that. If you swap in one word for another word in your search query, then Google thinks, maybe those words are kind of similar. Let me look at behavior of other people. So Google learns synonyms that way. And by the same process, Google learns languages by having a corpus of documents they use that have translated text from one to another. It can learn by the same algorithm how language works, and that's how Google Translate works. So more and more, you can see how artificial intelligence really is integral to what Google does. And I think, you know, the number of things you could say, Google is an X company, Google is a Y company, Google is a technology company, Google is an internet company. Google, I think, is an artificial intelligence company as well.
Well, I think in using it, I'm seeing it more and more, how much it needs to get at this. But this is also where perhaps they're going to start to increasingly get in trouble and have, which is how much information they have about people and how they're using it. And I know, and the sort of conflict, it seems like, between what they're trying to do, which is really get what you want before you even know what you want. They are really, really trying hard.
There's a term, called zero query search at Google.
That's a little frightening, actually. You know, the culture of Google, it had for a long time a very experimental sense and still has it. So in the years you've been covering it, my question is, as it's grown, there's 24,000 people now. Do you still feel that? When you go there, do you still feel some sense of, like, this is an experimental place where, you know, you can see a guy dressed as a cow? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, it's sort of taken for granted now, a lot of these things. And I think maybe April Fool's has gone as far as you can take it now. You know, and there's an April Fool's infrastructure at Google. It's designed, and people work for months at these things there. So you could say it's clever, it's part of the culture, but it's not so spontaneous. And I think you could say, as a lot of things, yes, these things become institutionalized, and people get used to them. But it's still rather remarkable. You don't see it adopted outside of Silicon Valley a lot, the things they do with Google. Inside Silicon Valley, you see it's now startups, even Twitter. When you visit Twitter in the very early days, they had lifted a lot of the amenities that Google has and had it even in a small startup there. So I think in some senses, people think it's a good idea. It's a good idea to feed your employees. They don't leave the campus during the day, and they're happier. And happier employees maybe are less likely to be resentful of employees.
A lot of companies don't think that way, but Google always has. I want to actually switch, though, to, okay, culture of innovation. They bought YouTube because they could not themselves. They knew video was going to be important to where. They clearly saw that coming. But they couldn't, when they started with Google Video, they couldn't quite hit on the formula, and it was outside the company that happened. They bought YouTube.
Right.
So I guess a couple things. One is, do you think that was a good acquisition? Two, do you think that it was a sign that the company was perhaps less innovative than it had been?
I think it's definitely a sign that Google, as a bigger company, can't operate as nimbly and as freely as it could when it was small. And you can see that. Actually, the YouTube thing is a great example of that, because it turns out there is an amazing method by which you can compare the way Google's product was developed and the way YouTube was developed, because there was a big lawsuit that came, it was with the Viacom, filed against Google and YouTube, where all the emails, both sides came. And you can see,
I think you can tell that this book is one that you can just sort of jump into. You don't need a lot of technological knowledge, and he traces the beginning of Google to just about where they are today. And it's certainly an interesting organization. Even if you're not a user of Google services, a lot of them or any of them, it's probably still touched your life in one way or another. Well, that's it for this evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next week, and we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sing that lovely song, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was still